nutrient-dense patch of soil, laddie. It's time to get rooted in health. Welcome to the show, everybody. Welcome to the Rooted in Health podcast. This is my third take on the monologue. I want it to be pristine for you guys. So I hope you're enjoying the show. I hope you enjoy today's episode. I'm positive you will. If you're digging the show, whether you're a regular, you dabble in the show, or you're a first-time listener, if you like it, please subscribe to the show. That would be greatly helpful to us to help grow our show here. We have a fantastic, fun little grassroots show. It's tiny, but we'd like to grow it. So we'd love you to support our little show by subscribing. And if you like it, and if you're getting some value out of it, please tell your friends and family about it. We would love and appreciate that. But without further ado, today I'm speaking to a guy named Gary Groon. He recently started his own company. He has a fantastic all-natural sunblock that doesn't have the hormone-disrupting chemicals and the carcinogens, things like that, that can be associated with a lot of commercial sunblocks. So you'll hear about that. He's an interesting guy all around. He's a surfer. He's a lifelong surfer. He's got some cool stories and things to say about that. And his background is in chemical and mechanical engineering. And he's spent a good chunk of his life as a patent agent. And he's also an adjunct, having difficulty with that word, as you guys can tell, adjunct professor at Duke University. So, I mean, he's really accomplished. He's really smart. He's really diverse. He's really just a great, easygoing guy. I love talking to people like this. He's right up my alley. Super interesting, fun, easygoing, likes to mess around. But I start the show by picking his brain about polymers or plastics, which is very interesting. Like I mentioned, he has a background in chemical engineering, and he's been a patent agent for years, so he deals with a lot of this, you know, these materials. Oftentimes people will patent materials, and obviously plastics are huge. But I find plastics to be rather fascinating. I did a little bit of research and stumbled on some very fascinating facts, things about plastic. First of all, plastic, I didn't know this up until now. It's actually created by... What they do is they'll take gas or oil, you know, crude petroleum, whatever. They'll distill what are called hydrocarbons out of it. I Googled that as well. Hydrocarbons are essentially just molecules that consist of hydrogen and carbon only. It's right there in the name, hydrocarbons. So they take these hydrocarbons, and then depending on what type of plastic they're manufacturing, you know, whether it's plastic bags or some sort of harder, you know, plastic for a container, a storage container or something like that, they'll put it through their process using, you know, whatever mechanical means, whether that's, you know, mechanical pressure, heat, electricity, whatever. And then obviously there's chemicals. There's different mixes of chemicals that these different manufacturing places need to use to create the type of plastic they want. The scary thing is that These methods are proprietary, so they're protected by law. So that these companies that are creating, like, for example, food containers, you know, like, say, like a little plastic tray that has lunch meat in it, for example. I'm sure you've seen that before. Oscar Mayer and what have you. You know, they're not required to tell the grocery stores what their process is, what chemicals they're using. And so, hence, the consumer doesn't know. So that's a little scary. There's, you know, plastics are amazing. Everything is made of plastic these days. Computers, keyboards, this desk, you know, this chair I'm sitting on has tons of plastic, bottles, containers. I mean, it's such an amazing, useful thing, but it does come with drawbacks and problems. I actually heard a really great, very real quote recently that goes as such. In life, there really are no solutions, but only trade-offs. And if you think about it, really in any situation, that's true. You know, like in life, if you're a father and you have a strict gym routine, but your daughter's piano recital, you know, coincides with that, so you have to pick. You know, I think most people would choose the daughter's dance recital. No judgment if you choose the gym. But really, technically, either way, you're sacrificing something. You're sacrificing fitness. If you go to the recital, you're sacrificing, you know, relationship building, you know, having a solid relationship. Not that that will destroy your relationship with your daughter. And again, no judgment if you choose the exercise. You can be a phenomenal father and skip a piano recital. You know, it doesn't have to be both, or it doesn't have to be one or the other. Multiple things can be true at the same time. But that's true. So plastics are incredibly amazing. But as many of you, all of you probably know, they're filling up our landfills. 150,000 tons of plastic is dumped into the oceans, makes its way into the oceans every year. That's sad. I mean, obviously, we've all seen the commercials with the turtles in the six-pack ring holder. You know, very sad. It's killing animals. They eat it too. Not just sea life, but there's been reports of cows and other livestock eating plastic. So it's bad for our health. It's bad for animals. It's bad for the whole dang planet. So that's one of the bad news. I mean, the reason it's such a problem is because plastic takes 450 years just to begin to decompose. That's insane. And then after it starts to decompose, it can take up to 80 years to fully disappear off the planet, decompose, and not be an issue. So that's a problem. That's a big problem. The first usable piece of plastic was invented in 1907. Really cool stat. What that means is, every single piece of plastic that has ever been created, invented, has not even come close to begun to decompose. That's funny and that's scary at the same time. So technically, the first piece of plastic was invented in 1850. Pretty cool, by a guy by the name of Alexander Parks. So he created it. He called it Park Sign after his name, Park Scene, Park Sign, but it cracked easily and it was very flammable, so it didn't really go anywhere. But in 1907, a chemist by the name of Leo Hendrick discovered Bakelite, a plastic made from heated wood, alcohol, and tar. And this became known as the material of 1,000 uses. You know, cameras, appliances, telephones, all sorts of stuff across the planet they would start to make. So 1907 is really when plastic became a viable thing. So it's been just a hair over 100 years. So they're not even a quarter of a way to beginning decomposing. So I believe with recycling and developing new plastics that decompose faster and aren't as toxic, I believe those things are happening. They are happening. But the question is, have we done too much damage already? Can we reverse it? Or have we just gone too far? Because, I mean, there's still obviously tons of damage happening. But I'm optimistic. So it's very interesting. So, yeah, they take these. So I guess how plastic is made, they'll take these hydrocarbons and process them with the chemicals and whatever mechanical and heat and whatever means they need to make the plastic they need. And essentially what makes it a plastic is they'll take these individual monomers, these little individual units, molecules of hydrogen and carbon, they'll link them together to make these huge molecules. So that's essentially what plastic is all these monomers from the petroleum products processed, linked together to form plastics. Very interesting. You know, and microbes can't break them down. Bacteria, which is a good thing and a bad thing, you know, obviously they can't decompose very quickly at all. But, you know, it will prevent unwanted microbial growth, bacteria, yeast, fungus. They, you know, their little biters are just too small. They can't fit around these massive molecules that are plastics. So yin yang, hate love, that's life. There are no solutions, just trade-offs. Let me know what you think in the comments, if you agree with that or not. But if you're loving the show, please subscribe. Please tell your friends. Please help us share. Anyway, without further ado, here it goes. Here's the interview. Gary's very awesome. Enjoy. Give him some love, guys. Peace. And today on the program, we are joined by Dr. Gary Groon. He is an adjunct associate professor in the Pratt School of Engineering at Duke University, owner of Third Rock Essentials skincare products, and just an all-around interesting and amazing guy. Thanks for joining us today, Gary.
Thank you. Nice introduction.
Yeah. Thanks for being on the show. We greatly appreciate it. So you have a background in mechanical and chemical engineering, chemistry, polymer science as a researcher. You're also an inventor, a teacher, a lecturer, and a registered U.S. patent agent. That's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it just means I'm old.
Okay. Okay, I won't argue with you there. all that time to acquire all that experience and wisdom and knowledge, huh?
I guess so. The good news is I don't feel old, or at least most of the time anyway. So
yeah, that is good news. Tell us a little bit about your education background. I know you got your bachelor's at Duke, is that correct?
I did. I got a double degree or a double major. It's a long story with Duke, but I started out as a chemist and then switched over into engineering, and already had so many chemistry courses that I wound up getting both degrees in chemistry and mechanical engineering. Duke does not have Duke does not have a chemical engineering department. So I sort of made a chemical engineering degree out of one that didn't exist there, and then went on to get a master's and PhD in chemical engineering. And but Duke had a mechanical engineering material science department that gave me a lot of flexibility to take a lot of chemistry courses. So it worked out well. I was advised against doing it at the time, and I'm glad I did it, but it was a lot of work to get two diplomas in 4 years.
Yeah, I bet. You were somewhat of a pioneer, it sounds like.
I was definitely a pioneer, and definitely I was told by an advisor in the engineering school, don't do it. And I was, and at Duke, there's two different schools. There's a School of Engineering and there's Trinity College. So the problem was I had to switch over into the School of Engineering to get my engineering degree, which was accredited. But they had to have a special meeting about what they were going to do with me in Trinity. So, yeah, it was definitely the path of most resistance.
Which ground you and forged you into the fine man you are today.
Yeah, well, okay. Sounds good.
So, what did you get into right after college, after you got your PhD? What was your first job out of college?
Well, actually, I got my first job before my doctorate. So what happened was I went to work right away after I got my degrees at Duke.
Okay.
I worked as an R&D engineer for a company called Celanese, which was part of Fiber Industries, making alternatives to Kevlar. So we were doing research and development in the polymer science area. And went back to school in the field of polymer science at UMass Amherst. And then got my master's degree up there and then went to work for IBM in the Research Triangle Park in North Carolina, where I got all kinds of experience and knowledge, worked for them for almost 13 years. And they paid for me to get my doctorate at NC State in chemical engineering. So I actually didn't get my doctorate until I was already in my 30s and had a lot of work experience already by the time I got my doctorate.
Okay. Gotcha.
And it was all polymer science stuff, chemistry and polymer science, which led me to all the things that I eventually got interested in doing down the road.
Now, I've heard the word before. I used to know the definition, but for everybody and myself out there, what is a polymer?
Oh yeah, sorry. So it's plastics.
Oh, okay.
So, that's yeah. It. So you're almost too young to remember the movie The Graduate, but there was a scene in The Graduate that's a very famous scene with Dustin Hoffman where he's being told at the beginning of the movie, after he graduates college, a guy takes him, you know, and puts his hand on his shoulder and says, "Son, plastics." Because in the 60s and 70s, that was, you know, quite the field to be in, because it was a growing, booming field. And, you know, in hindsight, by the time I got into it, it was already not a booming field, but certainly a field where you can make a living. So, and plastics, as you know, there's a lot of issues with plastics now.
Yeah.
The people that are responsible for making a lot of plastics are now trying to get responsible for how do they reuse or dispose or what do they do with plastics, make them biodegradable. And I was on the leading edge of all that, you know, making things sustainable, green, renewable back in the early 90s already, when people were getting to realize that, you know, plastics were a real issue globally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How even is a plastic made? I'm guessing you know that process.
Well, yeah, it's a great question. So it turns out that there's so many different types of plastics that the answer to that question is it depends on the plastic.
Okay.
So everything from something you know as Teflon, mm-hmm. which is a perfluoro or a fluoropolymer, which is fluorinated polymer, that's made at very, very high temperatures. Like when I say very high, I'm talking like 500 degrees centigrade, which is scorching hot. The aluminum melts at 700 degrees centigrade, for example.
Teflon is a polymer, is a type of plastic.
It is. So you have, wow. if you or your mom, who I met, has you know, Teflon coated pottery or pans, or, you know, it's the no stick stuff, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Believe it or not, that is a polymer. That is a Teflon is a trade name for a whole bunch of fluorinated polymers that were developed initially by DuPont.
Right.
Kevlar is another polymer, which is used for making everything from tires to bulletproof vests. A six pack holder is a polymer, but it's polyethylene.
Polyethylene.
So depending on which polymer you're talking about, the process of making it can be quite different.
Gotcha.
It could be anything from solution polymerization, which means they make it in a vat of, you know, either liquid or molten material. And then there's extruders, which make wire and cable, if you want to extrude something, you know, out, to process the polymers. But the synthesis of the polymers is usually carried out in a big manufacturing facility, which most of them now are in China. We've pretty much, in the United States, there's not a lot of polymer synthesis plants anymore, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending how you look at it.
Yeah, there's good and bad things to that. That's exactly. Interesting. Yeah, and while we're talking about it, it's not ideal to store food and to cook food and to heat, to just eat off of plastics. And Teflon is really bad. I saw it was a movie, with Mark Ruffalo. But yeah, it tells the DuPont story and how, do you know the name of that chemical? It's like something nine, like C9 or something, or C8. It's the chlorofluorohydrocarbon or...
Yep, the chlorofluorohydrocarbons. Those are have, you know, damaged the atmosphere, and that's been going on for quite some time. And, you know, of course, I mean, I look at both sides of the coin because I grew up in the polymer plastic industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of that was done with full knowledge that it was toxic, harmful stuff. Some of it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it wasn't. But DuPont had a very big toxicology lab where they could understand what were the consequences of what they were making. And a lot of times they did sort of hide that information. I agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So throw out your Teflon cookware, everybody.
Yeah. Well, it turns out that, you know, again, it's the off gassing of the Teflon that causes all the toxicity issues and can really be a problem.
Okay.
I've got a lot of anecdotes about Teflon and Teflon coated polymers and plastics. And it turns out that when I worked at IBM, I was actually involved with DuPont heavily in developing something called plenum cable. And it turns out that plenum cable is insulated with Teflon.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, hard to believe that. But again, there's so many different types of polymers and different types of Teflon that the stuff that's put, the stuff that's coated on a pan and pot is way different than the stuff that's, you know, extruded onto a cable as a cable jacket. So, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I have it's like a plumbing sealant. It's blue. Mm-hmm. And that has Teflon in it.
Yes. Well, for good reasons, because again, Teflon is frictionless. So
really?
It's pretty much
that nonstick.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not, the reason it's nonstick is because it is actually like the lowest friction polymer or plastic there is. And so you literally, the coefficient of friction for Teflon is so low that you could basically, you know, for example, if you had a toy truck or a car or whatever, and you pushed it along a Teflon surface, the thing would go like an order of magnitude further for the same amount of energy because there's no friction.
Interesting.
As opposed to if you did it on a stone or a wood surface, you know, it'd be completely. So yeah, so Teflon, when they first discovered Teflon, they realized that, holy cow, nothing sticks to it, you know, but the reason is because it's frictionless, almost.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
That's cool. We could probably talk forever. I could pick your brain
forever.
We could
talk forever about polymers, yeah, for plastics. I definitely could talk forever about that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting stuff. Are a surfer or were a surfer for a long time? Do you still surf?
Well, I do surf still. Mm-hmm. And, I try to get in the water when there's waves. So I guess I'm still a surfer, yes.
And you currently reside in Virginia Beach, right?
That's right. Yeah, Virginia Beach, Virginia. Yep.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Cool little town. I went there last year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, my sister-in-law lives in Washington, D.C. She actually works for a congresswoman from Virginia. I don't know her name.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but
I might know who she is. That's fine.
All I know is she's a Democrat. That's all I know.
So. Well, would you know it if I said it?
It's possible. Go ahead, throw it.
Luria? It wouldn't be Luria, would it?
That doesn't ring a bell.
Okay, because I think that's the lady that's from our district.
Okay,
who is a Democrat, which is interesting, but
it may be. My girlfriend told me. A couple times, but yeah, it was a while back, and I don't.
It left you.
Yeah, it sure did. So, how old were you when you started surfing?
I did not start till I was 30.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. That's probably why I'm not a very good surfer.
That explains.
It's a lot harder to learn when you're 30 than when you're 13. That's for sure.
Yeah. I'm a big guy. I've struggled with my weight for most of my life. I took a surfing lesson in Hawaii, in Maui one time, and I think I got up once, and it was exhilarating. Absolutely. So there's hope for me.
There definitely is.
Hope floats. Before we get into your sunblock, I ran into a little interesting tidbit. You once tried to, I mentioned you were an inventor. You once,
right.
Invented a shark resistant surfboard. Is that true?
I did. Let's put it this way. I have a couple of patents on shark resistant, shark, detecting, transparent surfboard. And, I still have a few patents on that. And that came about, you know, during these, we had a lot of shark attacks along the East Coast starting back in the early 2000s.
Really?
And so I had watched some National Geographic special on it. I had done some homework on what causes sharks to be attracted or not attracted. And it turns out that, you know, sharks have most of their neural senses at the front of their head. There's actually a part of the shark's brain that can be affected by different frequencies that are emitted. So one of the things you can do is you can actually build a frequency emitter into the board that would keep the sharks, you know, at bay, hopefully. But you have to be careful because at the wrong frequency could also attract the shark.
Right.
So I said, well, that's not enough. You got to do something more than that. So I said, well, what about shark detector? Well, the shark detector is just simply an alarm system that detects any fish bigger than 3 feet that's within, you know, a few feet of you. And of course, just knowing that there's a bigger than a 3 foot fish around, you know, that'll get a shark, that'll get a surfer's attention. Mm-hmm. And then the whole transparent part was because there were a lot of shark attacks where sharks were coming up from underneath the boards, thinking that the person on the board was a turtle. In fact, that happened to me while I was coming back from a trip to Australia, Japan, and then Hawaii. And on the way back from Japan, as I got into Honolulu, I had a guy pick me up because I had luggage. And he said to me, when he pointed at my surfboard, he said, what are you doing with that? I said, well, I'm in Hawaii. You know, this guy was big. I mean, I'm sure he's bigger than you are. This guy couldn't tuck his Hawaiian shirt into his shorts. He was a lion. And so he said to me, well, you heard about the shark attack. And I said, no, I've been in Japan and Australia for the last 3 weeks. I haven't heard about anything. And I was, you know, flying in to meet my family in Honolulu. And he goes, there was a shark attack, you know. And I said, well, it's probably not where I'm going. He goes, well, where are you going? I said, I'm going to Kauai. He goes, yep. He says, where in Kauai? And I didn't know where in Kauai because I'd never been to Kauai. I said, I think it's Kapa. He goes, oh, Kapa. He goes, yep, that's where it was. Wow. So it took us about 10 days to get to Kauai because we had to go to the Big Island. And, you know, family had never been to Hawaii. I'd never been to Hawaii. Everybody was looking around doing stuff. So we get there. We finally get to the hotel in Kauai. And everybody's hungry. They want to go and eat, you know, and I want to get in the water. I've been dying to get in the water. So I have my surfboard. I pick my surfboard out. I'm walking into the lobby with my surfboard, and the lady behind the desk there says to me, where are you going with that? And I said, so you're the second person that's asked me that. I said, what are you from, like, the Chamber of Commerce here? She goes, you realize that the shark attack was right out behind here. And it turns out it was. It was right at the Kapaa River mouth. Wow. And the shark was distracted and thought it was turtles.
Wow.
And so I get out there, and this is the eeriest. I was the only surfer out there. And it was, you know, it was right around sunset. It was right twilight. And I'm sitting out there going, you know, I think maybe it is time to go eat.
Yeah. You didn't want to just hop on your board and jump in the water, huh?
Well, I did. But I didn't stay out very long. I was the only guy out there.
Yeah, that would be kind of very menacing.
It was a little eerie.
Yeah.
And then for the last week we were there, all they did was show people going out and catching female sharks and ripping them open. As if what? They were going to catch the shark that bit this guy. And the other part was that the big guy that helped me with my luggage when I was at the airport in Honolulu, he says, yeah, you can check the paper out. So I still have the Honolulu Times. Mm-hmm. And on the front page of the Honolulu Times, it has a picture of the surfer in the hospital bed with his leg up, you know, with a big bite out of it from the shark. Mm. And he's quoted as saying, PAL surfing. So I said to the big Hawaiian guy, I said, PAO surfing, what's that? He go, oh, PAL is Hawaiian for never again.
Yeah, it's a good time to hang it up. You know, you hear stories about he had his leg bitten off by a shark. They have their arm bitten off and they still got in the water. You know, it's okay to hang it up. It's okay. I respect that. That's fine.
Yeah, so I'm not sure. The unfortunate thing is I never created the board. I never have gotten anybody to create the board that does all that. And, but it's still something that ought to be done because there are a lot of shark attacks every year. You just don't hear about them all.
Well, you know where you need to go if you decide to get this board off the ground. You know where you need to go, right?
Well, probably California, Hawaii, or Florida. Those are the three places I know.
True. I was thinking Shark Tank, the show Shark Tank.
That's a great point. Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a great point.
That's right.
That is a great point. They'd probably at least have a good time with it, right?
Yeah, they'd be like, "We're the sharks. Why would we support something that that turns us away?" You know, yeah,
that's right. It takes us exactly.
That's funny. That's really cool, man. I think that's really cool. Yeah, I mean, that's one of those things. It's like these really cool ideas, you know, and this life hack. But I mean, yeah, if you send out the wrong signal, the wrong frequency to that shark, you might, you know. You might get a love tap by the shark instead of
you want a shark repelling board, not a shark attracting board.
Yeah, that's interesting though. That that's the theory. They think they're mistaking surfers for turtles. What do you think? I mean, if they saw you, I mean, could they see you? Through a transparent board, could they see a human, or is there vision?
They probably could, but at least with a transparent board, you'd be able to at least see them first, hopefully.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I didn't think about that part, you being able to see them. Yeah, I didn't even think about
that. Yeah, well, there was that one girl, she's pretty famous, Bethany somebody. She was at, Hanalei Bay, and she got bit. She was a teenager, and she got bit. And they, you know, the shark tore her right arm off, but she survived amazingly and became a professional surfer with one arm.
Yeah.
I mean, she's an amazing, amazing lady. Right. Yeah. So, but if she had known that there was a shark that close, that would have never happened to her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. She would not have lost a limb and there's been other people who lost limbs and lives because they never saw it. You know, they never saw the shark or even had an idea the shark was close by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's scary. Yeah, I know who you're talking about. Yeah, the little blonde girl.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Yeah. So you this journey founding Third Rock Essentials kind of started with because of your surfing. Tell us about that. You tell us about why you wanted to create a sunblock that was chemical free and didn't cause all the harm that these sunblocks have. What led you to want to do that?
Sure. Well, you said, you know, when did you start? I started when I was 30, but I had a couple of guys that were younger, a lot younger. One guy, 20 years old, that we would go surf when I started surfing, we'd go surf together, and he developed melanoma at age 20. Mm. And I was like, wow, really? And his doctor, his dermatologist at the time told him, you can surf, you can keep surfing, but you'll get melanoma again. So he quit at age 20.
Wow.
And I had another kid that came and worked with me and his mom said, you better talk to Gary because he's got this, you know, basically stuff that will hopefully help people not get skin cancer in the first place. And he was only 18 when he got melanoma. And in both cases, didn't run in the family. Was hereditary. It was basically overexposure to the sun. So as a surfer myself, not wanting to get skin cancer and wanting to surf for a long time, which I still do, and finding out that at age 65 in the United States, there's a 50-50 chance you'll get some form of skin cancer. Obviously the sunscreens are not working. So I had made that trip I just mentioned from Australia, where they every day told you what the sun factor was because they had the ozone hole over the whole country, basically, in those days. This is in the late 90s. And then I went to Japan, then went to Hawaii. And, you know, there was all these issues about, well, what sunscreen should you use? What's going to make you safe? And then this woman came out with an article in 2001, Margaret Schlumpf. She is a toxicologist at the University of Zurich in Switzerland. And she had lathered back of female rats with conventional sunscreens and found out that they were all female mimicking hormones, which is toxic stuff. And the way she found out is the uterus of the rats, so the female rats grew abnormally large. So when I found all that out in 2001, plus my trip, which was in the early 90s that I told you about, plus I wanted to keep surfing, I said, well, now it's time for me to do something about it. So I literally started making it in the garage. And then I had to came up with a name with it, which my youngest daughter at the time was like, well, let's see. I said, what about Third Rock Sunblock? In those days, you could call it a sunblock. Now the FDA doesn't allow you to call it that anymore. It's a sunscreen.
Hmm.
And I said, well, Third Rock Sunblock, what do you think? And she said, well, Dad, it rhymes. So you'd have to know my oldest daughter to realize that that was a big positive, you know. I was like, okay, so maybe that'd be a good name. Right. And my idea was, well, Third Rock is the earth. And all my products are earth grown only instead of quote unquote all natural, which means nothing. So we wanted to make a non-toxic, non-endocrine disrupting, cytoprotective, immuno-enhancing sunscreen, which is the title of my first patent in that space. And that patent was granted in 2005. And I'm sort of the father of making sunscreens with zinc oxide only, because it turns out that zinc oxide only is the best UVA and UVB protectant that you can put on your skin and not toxic. So that's how all that developed. And that's been going on, gosh, 20 years ago now. Hard to believe.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really cool that you did that. What are some of those gnarly chemicals in there that are causing these increases in estrogen, you know, these endocrine disrupting chemicals?
Yeah, the gnarly chemicals, you're right. Well, the good news is they're not plastics, but they are chemicals. And you're talking about things like avobenzone, oxybenzone, the benzyl phthalates, the methoxycinnamate. These are all what they call organic sunscreens. And the reason they're so prevalent is they do sort of work, and we can discuss that, not too well, actually, but only for UVB, except for avobenzone, which is used for UVA. But they're transparent, and they're inexpensive. They're synthetic man-made compounds that are inexpensive, clear, so they go on, and you can't really tell you have sunscreen on. But they're toxic, and they are female-mimicking hormones in all cases, and that is not healthy for men, and it's really not healthy for women either. Mm-hmm. Because, for obvious reasons with men, you don't want to put female-mimicking hormones on your body. For women, it turns out that can lead to things like breast cancer. Mm-hmm. So when you start messing with the hormones and the hormone balance in the body, you don't want to have, you don't want to have things that are going to change that, at least not synthetically change that.
Yeah.
And so my goal was to make something that was completely free of all that and still work. And that sounded easy, and it was easy to write the patent application and get the patent granted. It was not easy to make the product.
So what are there some other health concerns that can happen other than endocrine disruption? Is there?
Oh, yes.
Cancer,
so
things like that?
Well, so from a sunscreen standpoint, I mean, the problem is the sunscreen actives are the endocrine disruptors that I just mentioned, but it turns out the inactives, there's a lot of inactives that are endocrine disruptors too. And even some things like soy, for example, and soy lecithin, which is an emulsifier, is a natural endocrine disruptor. It's not synthetic. It's not made by man. It is. I mean, soy lecithin is, but soy has genistein in it, and so it is an endocrine disruptor, female mimicking hormone. And so it turns out that there's a lot of gunk that goes into making the sunscreens, a lot of which are toxic. My goal was to make something that was proactive and that would benefit you. And it has, and we make an aromatherapeutic version so that it boosts the immune system. Because the last thing you want in the presence of the sun, which is the biggest free radical generator, which is not even, on the earth, but onto the earth. So the problem is overexposure and generating free radicals. And that's what eventually leads to immune deficiencies, which when your immune system is down can lead to all kinds of problems, including cancer. And so what I wanted to do was make something that would fortify you and make your immune system stronger in the presence of the sun rather than weaker, because the endocrine system is about basically discharge from all your organs. And if you disrupt the discharge from your organs, what happens is that your immune system has to work overtime to compensate for that. So for example, when you're in the sun, normally, on a summer day, or even on a winter day, if you're skiing, you're going to be sweating, you're going to be perspiring. And now you got to put stuff on your skin that is your biggest organ. And now you've got endocrine disruptors to deal with, which means that your skin, which is your biggest organ, isn't perspiring properly. Mm. Your kidneys aren't discharging properly. Your lungs are not respirating properly because you've got this gunk on your skin that's literally retarding the ability to do all those things and making your immune system more deficient in the presence of the sun, which can eventually lead to DNA damage and skin cancer. So it's very backwards what we do with the sunscreens, the toxic ones. I mean, a lot of companies have cleaned it up over the last 20 years, but there's still a lot of stuff out there that's garbage.
Yeah, that's interesting that it can cause all those systems to disrupt, just like sort of by, like you mentioned, blocking the natural drainage of the skin.
Right.
That's interesting. They can go in there and cause all that. Your sunblock, when worn, do you still get the positive benefits of the sun, you know, to help your body create the serotonin and the melatonin and all that stuff?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So, you know, of course, you're supposed to have 20 minutes of direct exposure to sunlight a day for vitamin D. And vitamin D synthesis, and of course, with COVID, that's been a real big issue, is making sure your vitamin D levels are sufficient.
Yeah.
And also keeping your immune system strong. So what I tell people is, look, unless you dip coat yourself in sunscreen, you're still going to get all the vitamin D you need by being in the sun for 20 minutes plus. The problem is, it's not the 20 minutes, right? If everybody just did 20 minutes of sun exposure a day, even in the middle of the day, and got all the vitamin D they needed, the problem is, what do you do after that? It's the overexposure, right? So it's the overexposure that you want to guard against. So with the sunscreens, you're able to do that. But there's two forms of light. There's UVB and UVA that matter. It turns out that SPF, which is sun protection factor, is related only to UVB light. And so this is how upside down the FDA has it. So SPF 30, for you or me, you know, white Caucasians, you know, SPF 30, let's say 20 minutes in the sun, we start to turn pink. Well, in 20 minutes times 30, which is sun protection factor 30, that means you would have 600 minutes of protection from burning or turning pink in the presence of the sun. 600 minutes is 10 hours, right? Well, first of all, as you probably know, no sunscreen lasts 10 hours in the presence of the sun, especially if you're going to perspire, or you're going to do any water sports or whatever you're going to do. Secondly, it's only UVB. So UVB are the short, high energy rays from the sun that allow you to burn, but don't necessarily do a lot of DNA damage. It's the UVA long penetrating rays that do that. They really do a lot of DNA damage. And if you've ever been sunburned in your life, you woke up the next morning sore. You woke up the next morning sore from UVA, not from UVB. And the UVA light doesn't really burn that much. It just destroys DNA and also causes chain scission, which is a polymer science term, actually, which means it's breaking apart some of the cells of the skin. So what happens is, and this is what's really sad, is with SPF, you get a false sense of security because you're not burning as fast as you normally would. Like, for example, SPF 2 is water. SPF 4 is oil. And your mom was probably, you know, sunbathing, you know, back in the 60s, 70s, whatever, with oil, with mineral oil on, which, you know, you wouldn't burn and first. And it used to be called tanning lotion, you know, back in those days. Well, the FDA got a hold of all this back in the 70s and early 80s and said, you know, this really ought to be regulated as a drug. And what we're going to do is we're going to put this SPF number out there. And that's what's going to cause people to, you know, use it only as long as until they get burnt. Well, think about it. If you're out there and you're in the water or you've got a little bit of oil on you, whatever, you're still going to get an SPF of 2 in the water. That means instead of 20 minutes, you've got 40 minutes of protection. And or an SPF 4 with oil, you've got maybe 100 minutes of protection. From what? From burning. But not necessarily from any UVA, which is the deadly stuff, really. And so what happens is people tend to be out longer in the sun because they're not burning. But your body, without anything on it, after 20 minutes, when you start to burn, what are you going to do? Your tendency is going to be to get the hell out of the sun. Right?
Yeah.
But now we've got people putting sunscreen on saying, well, I'm going to be fine. I got SPF 30 on.
Right.
You know, I got 10 hours of protection here. Well, yeah, you do from UVB, maybe, but you certainly don't from UVA. And therein lies the problem.
So with, because, third, yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, well, UVA is the issue, right? UVA is the, it's sort of like the killer bees. You got, you'll get stung with UVB and then you'll get, you know, poisoned by UVA.
Gotcha. Okay.
Right.
So, Third Rock sunblock, would you recommend people, wait to put it on, wait and get that 20 minutes of exposure first, or are they going to get enough, of the good sun?
Wow. That's a great question. I never, no one's ever asked me that question of all the sunscreen questions I've answered over the last 20 years. It's a great question. I would say this. I would say no. I would say you'd put it on right away.
Okay.
Let it soak into your skin. Our product is glycerin-based. It takes longer to soak in, and it also does not evaporate. So all the other sunscreens, and I mean every single other sunscreen on the planet, is made with 70% water. We use 70% glycerin. So our product does not evaporate, ever. So, again, this goes back to your mom. A little dab will do ya. That was a Brill Cream commercial when we were growing up. And that's true with our sunscreen because our sunscreen does not evaporate. So think about it. Every other sunscreen is 70% water. Why?
Wow.
Well, water's almost free. Mm-hmm. And water and oil sort of do a good job of at least being aesthetically pleasing on your skin. Mm-hmm. But you have to put an emulsifier in to keep it. So, you know, I would recommend you put it on right away. You let it soak in. You're still going to get sun. It's going to block all the rays. You're going to get sun, you know, through your, well, if you're not bald, you're going to get sun your hair. If you are bald, you probably put it on your head anyway, because any place your skin is really, really thin, you're much more susceptible to skin damage.
Oh, okay.
Right. So in places where your skin is really, really thin, you want to make sure to get it on like your ears, your nose, your face, your neck, your shoulders, your knees, your ankles, but any place where your skin is thin. And then where it's thicker, you know, sure, you could wait 10, 15, 20 minutes to put it on. But in the meantime, remember, you know, you're going to, if you're going to be in the sun more than 20 minutes, you're going to get plenty of vitamin D.
Okay.
And you're not going to be able to cover up every inch of your skin. It's just not going to happen.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. So zinc oxide is the primary agent there. What are the other ingredients? You mentioned vegetable glycerin. What are the, what are the other ingredients in it?
Right. So, you know, in the best of all worlds, those two ingredients alone would be perfect. But the problem that with that is you have to put things in, like we use beeswax and orange wax, which helps emulsify. Mm-hmm. We don't need the emulsifier, so we don't have a toxic emulsifier that keeps the oil and water together. So we have a gamma arisenol, which is a SPF enhancer. It's a strong antioxidant. We also have in the quote unquote aromatherapeutic version, we use rosemary and frankincense, which is again a strong immuno-enhancing compound.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fragrance, really. It's just two essential oils. And then we make an unscented version without that in it. We take the zinc oxide and we chelate it with something called L-arginine. And by doing that, we've changed the zinc oxide composition so that the product never turns into toothpaste.
Oh.
And there's a reason for that. It turns out zinc oxide, when you add water to it, which is everybody else, it turns into zinc hydroxide, which is a salt, and it literally salts out of the sunscreen, which is why most sunscreens have a shelf life that's 1 to 2 years if they're using zinc oxide only. And the reason is it turns into toothpaste, and zinc oxide is very effective in the presence of the sun. Zinc hydroxide is not.
Oh, okay.
Interesting. So there's actually a chemical reaction occurring in all zinc oxide sunscreens. We're probably the only exception to that rule. In fact, I think we are the only exception to that rule because we use glycerin. We don't use water. We chelate with L-arginine to get the pH above 9.5. And those are all things that nobody else on the planet does because nobody figured out, you know, that that's an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody will tell you it's an issue because it's still better than all the other gunk that's out there.
Tell us about that chelation. What exactly is chelation?
Sure.
You mentioned L-arginine. That's an amino acid, isn't it?
It is. It is. You're exactly right. It's an essential amino acid. You know, things happen for a reason. I patented all that. I came across the fact that through a polymer science paper, I came across the fact that zinc oxide becomes zinc hydroxide at a pH above below 9.5 mm-hmm. or above 3. Well, it wasn't much choice. So what I did was I said, okay, how am I going to make sure that my pH does not drop below 9.5 and make something that's still usable and friendly for the skin and good for the body? And the answer happened to be L-arginine. So what I do, the answer to your question is chelation is a mild reaction, a mild chemical reaction, let's say.
Okay.
If you take zinc supplements, for example, most of those are chelated zinc.
Okay.
Because it's bioavailable and it makes the inorganic substance organic, which is compatible with your organs, et cetera. But I didn't do that for the sunscreen that way. I did it just to make sure that I didn't have zinc oxide becoming zinc hydroxide, which is the salt that causes the sunscreen to turn into toothpaste.
So, so if you use some old sunscreen that's just been sitting there for 5 years, it's going to be worthless. Mm-hmm. It's not even going to do its job, right? Because that zinc oxide will have turned to zinc hydroxide.
Well, that's certainly, if it's a zinc oxide compound that's been in there for 5 years, the chances are when you open the tube up, it's going to be like toothpaste. So you wouldn't even be able to really spread it on your skin very well. And yes, it's a good probability that's mostly zinc hydroxide. I wouldn't say zinc hydroxide is not going to be effective. It's just going to be much less effective.
Okay. It'll be a little bit
much less effective, especially in the UVA range, which is what really causes most people's skin cancer problems.
Gotcha. I love these issues that you're tackling with the sunblock. The fact that, you know, you take away the water base, that makes sense. Like, you got the evaporation and you're in the water, it's going to come off easily. The vegetable glycerin, the beeswax, orange wax, that helps keep it, it's like kind of sticky, but not really, and it helps keep it on your skin. And and you've taken out, not only have you taken out the toxic chemicals, but I love that you have added certain things in order to boost your immune system and actually make it more effective. That's genius. So yeah, that's really cool. So, Third Rock sunblock.
We call it Third Rock sunblock sunscreen. The name of the company is Third Rock Sunblock Incorporated, but we go by Third Rock Essentials because we also make other stuff besides sunscreen. Now, the reason we call it Third Rock Sunblock Sunscreen because the FDA doesn't let you call it sunblock anymore.
Right. You're not blocking the sun. You can't say that.
That's right. That's right.
So, yeah, let's talk about some of your other stuff. You have a product called Silver Infusion. Let's talk about that one. Mm-hmm. What's going on with that one?
Well, Silver Infusion is a product that grew out of a couple other things that I was developing. It turns out that in addition to chelating zinc oxide, we chelate silver oxide. So the silver oxide, you know, colloidal silver is something you can buy like Sovereign Silver at the Vitamin Shop or whatever. And they sell it for, you know, they sell 10 parts per million, which is basically 99.999% water and 0.001% silver. But it works because silver is very, very toxic to any infectious bacteria. Well, for us, I started out working with a guy that I was making the sunscreen with. And, you know, he had figured out how to chelate silver, but he didn't figure out how to infuse it into plastic. And so we actually take, instead of making colloidal silver, which is made basically in a bathtub with two electrodes. So you basically have a silver electrode and an anode or a cathode, and you put energy through, and the silver ions, they go into the water. You know, it's usually distilled water or deionized water. Mm-hmm. And that's what you're buying when you buy Sovereign Silver and colloidal silver. But doing that process takes a lot of time, a lot of energy, and you can only make a certain concentration of silver. Well, it turns out if you buy silver oxide powder like we do, so it's actually the actual silver oxide powder, and we then take that and we chelate it, again, the mild reaction thing that we talked about for zinc oxide, we chelate that with citric acid, and we make, instead of an inorganic colloidal silver, we make an organic, inorganic silver oxide, which is chelated with citric acid. Citric acid is the lifeblood of all cells. It's part of the Krebs cycle. And every cell that's biological, whether it be animal, plant, or human, needs citric acid to stay alive and to create energy so that the cell can perform the cell's function. So our chelated silver oxide is in the Silver Infusion product. It's also in basically every other product we make except for the sunscreen and something called Itch Block, which is sort of a highly concentrated form of our sunscreen, which wipes out poison ivy and bee stings and all that. But that's a separate product. But so Silver Infusion is a diluted version. We make it at 4,000 parts per million. We make something called Silver Excelsior, which is a 1 ounce tincture, if you will. And it's at 4,000 parts per million instead of 10 or even 100. If you made colloidal silver in the bathtub and you left it in there long enough and made, say, a couple hundred parts per million, it would turn yellowish brown. Our product, because it's chelated with citric acid, which is highly soluble in water, is completely clear. Like, you can look at it and you wouldn't know the difference between what's in a 1 ounce bottle dropper of water and our chelated silver oxide, which is 4,000 ppm, which sounds like a lot, but it's still 96% not silver. It's only 4% silver, but it's not 0.004% silver. So what we do with the silver infusion product is we dilute it down to 150 parts per million, which is much more ingestible, as much silver concentrate as you need to wipe any infectious bacteria. And we use that silver-based product for making everything else as well, including we make several different products which are silver oxide-based. We make something called Rash Block, Nutrisporin, we infuse that into the gel, the silver into the gel. And then we also make a deodorant spray and a breath spray. It turns out that the silver oxide wipes out all infectious bacteria. And infectious bacteria, any bacteria, really. And the bacteria that dies causes odor. So that means odor in your mouth, odor under your arms, odor wherever that bacteria, that's where most of the odor comes from. Mm-hmm. So if you wipe out the bacteria, you wipe out the opportunity for the odor to occur in the first place.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So that makes sense to me.
So the silver oxide that we make is chelated. That's patented too. And chelated with citric acid makes it bioavailable and biocompatible, as opposed to colloidal silver, which is just ionic, inorganic substance that goes through you and does wipe out infectious bacteria, but it goes through you sort of like vitamin C does. Our silver, because it becomes part of the Krebs cycle, really gets into the nucleus of the cell. And if the cell is infected with, you know, all kinds of gunk, it'll wipe it out. We have a paper from Mexico, two papers from Israel, and a paper from Japan that describes how silver oxide wipes out COVID. But, of course, the FDA would never let us tell anybody that. And the FDA does not like silver because it works.
Don't even get me started on the FDA.
Right. I won't.
I'm sure you have a lot more firepower than I do. You've probably had to work with them more than I have, but,
Right. Well, it's as you know, and your mom knows well, they're a government agency and they're here to help.
Absolutely. They have our best interest in mind.
Which
is what I love.
They always do.
Guys, I just want to be wrapped up in that cozy FDA blanket. Tell me what's safe and what's not, FDA. I need to know, baby. Let's go.
That's right. Well, there is a reason why you live in Utah, and there is a reason why I don't live in D.C. So,
gosh. Hell no. I wouldn't want to live in any major city. Luckily, Utah is not that bad for now.
It's not.
I worry about the eventual Californication of Utah, but
I do too. I'm with you there.
So the silver infusion, it can be used. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, you know, during this whole COVID thing, have been using hand sanitizer.
That's right.
Like, why is that a bad idea? And why is this a better choice? Why is the silver infusion better?
Well, hand sanitizer is a bad idea for a lot of reasons. It's alcohol based.
Yeah.
By definition. So if it is a hand sanitizer and it's not alcohol based, at least according to the FDA, it's illegal, and the EPA, it's illegal.
Right. Okay? That's the allowed sanitizing agent is ethanol, right?
Right. It has to be 60% or more ethanol. Of course, ethanol dries your skin out.
Yeah.
And of course, I would definitely not want to drink that stuff. But it is it's usually denatured alcohol, which of course will make you blind if you drink it. But that's another story. but just using it for your hands, you've got about 5 to 10 seconds of protection against bacteria.
About 5 to 10 seconds. You've done,
5 to 10 seconds contact resistance, and then what happens is your skin's dry. So our product is water and glycerin based. So we don't just use water; we use water and glycerin. Glycerin's a humectant. It brings moisture into the skin. And the water will evaporate from our – we make it in a spray bottle. We make it in a refill bottle. We also make the 1 ounce, 4,000 part per million, so you can make your own, dilute it down yourself. A lot of people don't know how to do that. That's why we make the what we call RTD, ready-to-drink bottle, which is the blue bottle, which is 16 ounces. But there we're just mostly shipping water. But the bottom line is our product will wipe out all infectious bacteria. Not just certain strains. Normally, the hand sanitizers use triclosan, which the FDA and the EPA have been trying to get out of the system, you know, but it's still around, and it isn't any antibacterial, antimicrobial substance, but it's toxic. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing about our stuff that's toxic. Like we say, if you wouldn't put it in your mouth, why would you put it on your skin? And that's true for all of our products. And the silver oxide that we're talking about, it certainly can be ingested, but you know, if you were to go on a plane and I've done this and you know, you have a mask you got to wear, then you could spray your mask with it with hand sanitizer. You're probably not going to spray your mask. So certainly with the COVID thing that's been going on, using the chelated silver oxide spray, which is the silver infusion in a spray bottle. I mean, that seems to be a very good thing to do. And people are even using our deodorant spray for that because it's got aloe and jojoba oil in it. So it stays on the skin even longer.
Yeah,
or on the mask even longer, right? So it actually creates a barrier for infectious bacteria.
That's a good idea.
And you probably heard that, you know, wearing a mask can be more of a health disaster than a health benefit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, part of the reason is the mask itself has bacteria mm-hmm. in it from you know, your breath and your mouth. And of course, you know, the carbon monoxide issue. So, you know, wearing a mask, certainly, I don't think anybody would argue wearing a mask is really not very health beneficial.
No.
But if you have to do it, mm-hmm. well, you know, at least you have something that would, you know, wipe out the bacteria. So that's how we developed the spray, only because a lot of people said, well, why don't you just make a hand sanitizer alternative? We can't call it a hand sanitizer because it doesn't have 60% alcohol in it.
Yeah.
But that's what the silver infusion spray is.
That's cool. And I love that idea. Because from what I can tell, it seems to me that the mask wearing business is causing more problems than it's actually solving anything. That's, you know, certainly there are others who might disagree but it seems to be just a whole lot of ridiculousness, but adding this silver spray to it is actually combating the problem you just mentioned, because I've heard that before. Like, okay, if you do have some viruses and all the other microbes you're breathing out, it's like a little home. It's a little nest in that mask, and it's not good to be like to have all that air right there just collecting all that stuff. So it's actually benefiting you, too, and actually making the mask maybe somewhat more effective. Maybe, I don't know, but...
Well, I'll tell you one thing we've been told by our customers is that it has eliminated what they call mask rash on the face.
Oh, okay. Mask rash.
Because it's more of a lubricant. You know, there's a little bit of glycerin in there. There's water. There's silver. So two things cause, you know, the mask rash. And one is bacteria. And the other is, you know, chafing, right? Just friction.
Mm-hmm.
And in both cases, you know, we're softening the mask up and we're eliminating bacteria. Pretty much all bacteria. And so that eliminates the whole thing that people have complained. Mostly women have complained about it causing some type of mask rash type rubbing against the skin type thing.
Oh, okay.
So I think that's a big benefit. But, you know, from my perspective, the bigger benefit is your mouth's carrying and your nose is carrying a lot of bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully not infectious bacteria, but if you're, you know, coming down with a cold or you've been exposed somewhere, you're going to breathe it in and breathe it out.
Yeah.
And it's going to wind up in the mask.
Yeah.
And so if it winds up in the mask, you've got a little, you know, a concentrating bowl of stuff that's right on your mouth and right on your nose. And if you if it's full of an infectious bacteria, the chances are it's going to affect your health.
Yeah. Yeah. So I never wear a mask unless I have to. It's really pretty much only when I fly, which isn't that often. So
good.
I have some of your I have some of your silver infusion. I'm definitely going to put a little on there.
Absolutely. That's the thing to travel with for sure.
Yeah. Let's see here. I was going to ask you about you mentioned your Nutrisporin.
Nutrisporin, yes.
Yeah, yes. So that's a playoff of Neosporin.
It is.
And so why is Neosporin bad, and what have you done to correct that, to give us a healthy alternative there?
Sure. Well, good question. Great question. So Neosporin, I wouldn't say is bad. I don't like to call anybody's baby ugly. They're all pretty, you know. Yeah. But Neosporin has some issues, right?
I'm more judgmental.
The biggest issue with Neosporin probably is that it is not a it is an antibiotic ointment. Mm-hmm. It has three, usually it's a triple biotic ointment, and that means it has three antibiotics in it. Mm-hmm. And what antibiotics do is they wipe out certain strains of bacteria. They're very selective, but they don't wipe out all strains of bacteria, infectious bacteria specifically. And so if you go to Wikipedia, you'll find it. You know, it says right there that Neosporin is guilty of allowing MRSA, which is staph, which is deadly bacteria, to proliferate. Mm-hmm. The reason is because none of the three antibiotics touch MRSA.
Interesting.
So here you are putting this stuff on thinking that you're going to help heal the cut or the bruise or the scrape. But if there's MRSA around, which is everywhere, by the way, it could actually exacerbate the issue. And that does happen sometimes. It's also a petroleum-based product. So there's nobody I know who would literally, you know, suck on, which kids do all the time. You put Neosporin on their thumb or on a cut or a bruise or a scrape, and, you know, kids, they're going to put it in their mouth. Mm-hmm. So you got a toxic substance that is on your skin or potentially in your mouth. Mm-hmm. And we have an alternative to that. And our alternative is called Nutrisporin because it's non-toxic. We use the chelated silver oxide in there to wipe out all infectious bacteria, including MRSA and E. coli and a whole bunch of other infectious bacteria that are not touched by Neosporin. And we're not petroleum based, right? We have a gel, and the gel is food grade edible. That's also patented. The gel is glycerin and something called heteroglucoside, which is a plant fat. If you've ever boiled vegetables in a pot, you ever seen the top globules come up, that is plant fat. And that's what the other ingredient is that we mix with the glycerin to make a food grade edible gel. And we take that food grade edible gel and we infuse it with silver oxide, the chelated silver oxide that we talked about at length. And that chelated silver oxide in the Nutrisporin product then can be used for wiping out infectious bacteria everywhere, including and especially wiping out UTI, which is urinary tract infections. Mm-hmm. So we've really had success there. In fact, incredible success. Changed many women's lives by them using the Nutrisporin, not only to wipe out UTI, but to keep it from ever coming back. We did a clinical study in Bremerton, Washington, with two nursing care facilities. A woman named Sue Honan came to me. She ran those at the time. She's now retired. She was using it for herself for UTI. She said, I want to try it on my residents. She put a dime size on the urethra twice a day for women who were getting UTI, habitually getting it, like every couple of weeks. They had one woman there on hospice. She was getting UTI every week. They were giving her antibiotics, which weakened the immune system, which unfortunately you've heard the expression, your grandma's loopy, because the UTI goes to the gut, then it goes to the brain within 24 hours. And this woman who was the hospice woman, she stayed there 9 more months and never had another UTI again.
Wow.
And so our stuff really works. But again, you know, we don't have FDA authority to say that we wipe out UTI and prevent it from coming back. And again, since we're not an antibiotic and we're not part of the FDA big pharma companies, we can't make any claims, and we don't. But you go online and read some reviews and you'll see that what I'm talking about is actually happening. And it's amazing. We were at Dave Osprey's Biohack conference in September of this year in Orlando.
Oh, cool.
And had a very young lady beautiful girl came to me and she's like, I need to talk to you right away. And I'm like, wow, you know, okay, what do you want to talk about? And she's like, well, I can't really talk about it loudly. So she brings me over into the corner and I'm like, what is this about? I had just been interviewed about Nutrisporn and about UTI. Turns out she had a UTI the night before the conference, spent 6 hours in the emergency room.
Oh, dear.
They gave her a shot and told her that she might not be able to attend the conference. The conference was in Orlando. She flew all the way from Oregon.
Wow.
And so she was like panicking, and she probably wasn't more than 25 years old. Well, I told her, you know, here's the Nutrisporn, here's the silver, take all that, you know, and then what you can do is, you know, just let me know how you feel in the morning. So she came back at 10 o'clock in the morning. And, what happened was she was like beaming. She's like, I don't know what you gave me, but I'm going to tell everybody about this because it totally cleared it up within, you know, a very, very short time.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's so cool. You have her take a little internally as well, the tincture?
Right, the silver oxide. Not the tincture so much as the silver oxide.
The silver infusion?
The silver infusion, yeah. I had her drink that and take a lot of fluids.
Okay, that's awesome. That's very cool. Let's see here. Let's see if there's anything. I am interested. Okay, I wanted to just talk to you a little bit about your work as a patent clerk, as a patent agent. How long have you been doing that?
Well, we've been doing the silver stuff for probably, I guess, 5 or 6 years now.
No, the how long have you been a patent agent?
Oh, doing the patent work?
Yeah.
I've been a registered patent agent since 1997.
97?
Yep.
Do you still do that?
I do. In fact, that's how we make money. Unfortunately, Third Rock Essentials is a hobby that's trying to be a business.
So go out and support Gary, you guys. He's got amazing products.
Right, exactly. With Third Rock Essentials needs to be supported because, you know, a hobby is a good thing to have, but a business is a better thing to have.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and especially the one we have, which, as Michelle says, you know, we're trying to help people, and we're doing it. But, you know, these alternative medical things, as you know right now with what's happened with COVID and, you know, everything from monoclonal antibodies to hydroxychloroquine, you know, all those were no-nos because Big Pharma had to make it that way based on all the laws that have been passed that says you can't have alternatives. If you have alternatives, then they don't get their emergency, you know, vaccination protocol in place. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard being an alternative medical type company.
Yeah.
We're topicals based, and we've had problems with Amazon. They've tried to delist us more than once. In fact, they have without any warning. But we've never gotten an FDA warning letter, knock on wood, because we don't make any claims.
Mm-hmm.
And we're very, very careful about what we say about our products. Michelle keeps me very honest there. You know, we try to sometimes say things more than we should. Like we had a guy who helped us with Amazon at the very beginning, and he, you know, just very innocently put on our website with Amazon that, you know, our silver oxide gels, and those in that time, we called it Rash Block. We still do. We have Nutrisporn. And he talked about diabetic ulcers. And within 8 hours, Amazon had us shut down.
Wow.
Because we said it was useful for diabetic ulcers, right?
That was a review? He was just leaving a review?
Yeah, well, it was a little bit more than that. He put it on the description of the product.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so, you know, that didn't take him very long to say goodbye to us, right?
Hmm.
So yeah, it's been a mess. But, you know, we've survived so far.
That's good. Have you been growing steadily despite the roadblocks?
Yeah, I would say we've had spurts. You know, it's been up and down. I'm sure your mom's business has had the same type of thing. You know, you have good times and not so good times. You know, this summer was good. We had a really good situation last March because everybody knew silver worked. They didn't know it worked against COVID as well as it actually does. And I told you about the papers we have that proves that. None of them, of course, from any scientist in the United States or China for that matter. But what happens is, you know, we were selling silver so much in March of 2020 when things were, you know, crazy and COVID was just a new buzzword that you couldn't talk 10 seconds without somebody talking about COVID. Well, what happened was a guy named Jim Baker, who was married to Tammy Faye Baker at the PTL Club, which is, we used to call it Pass the Loot Club. He had a woman come on his TV show after he got out of prison and, you know, claim that silver is, you know, really beneficial and could help you. She didn't make any claims. But what happened was it went on social media. Mm-hmm. And because Jim Baker had a very bad reputation, the FDA came after him and closed down two silver manufacturing companies and closed his site down. So he couldn't sell silver anymore. And it went social viral. And everybody that didn't know anything about silver was saying, oh, it's a hoax. You know, silver's a total hoax.
Yeah.
Doesn't work. Doesn't do anything. Doesn't help anybody.
Snake oil.
You shouldn't buy it. Right. And so we went from a $40,000 month to a $4,000 month.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So some days are good. Some days are not so good. Some months are good. Some months are not so good. We usually have a good summer turnout for the sunscreen, but quite frankly, we don't sell enough sunscreen to even justify making it. I call it artisanal sunscreen now because we make it in small batches, right? Where the FDA comes in. You have to meet FDA regs to make sunscreen. So you can't just make sunscreen in your kitchen and sell it. You know, they have to have an OTC facility. It has to be CGMP OTC. So yeah, big trouble in making sunscreen. You got to find a facility where you can make it that's, you know, approved. So now we've moved into a mall and start and are getting ready to make it ourselves there and have to get that facility approved because I'm tired of working with third parties who are crazy crooks. You know, they don't know what they're doing. And even if they do know what they're doing, they're just impossible to deal with. So we have a $10,000 water system just for making the water.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yeah. 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 Well, it's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
it's a lot.
I know you'll be successful. I have no doubt.
We try, you know, we do the best we can. And there's a lot of products in addition to the ones we already make that we'd like to sell. We haven't put Third Rock Hangover Block on the website yet, but that's a liver cleanse product.
Yeah.
Actually, your mom really liked that because she makes some, she sells a capsule for liver cleanse. I think it's a capsule.
Yeah.
That's the
Liver Love capsule.
Yeah, exactly. So she was interested in, you know, maybe having a liquid version, which we already make, but we just don't sell. Of course, that's how you and I met is because I started taking some of your mom's antiviral products because I am post COVID and I was and probably still am a little bit a long hauler. Most of my symptoms are gone now, but I contracted it last December, and a chiropractor came to me when I was up in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho last July and said, you know, I know about this stuff. And you ought to be interested in it. And he said, I'll test it on you. And so he had some of your mom's stuff, which I guess is really some of your grandfather's stuff.
Yeah.
And, and tested it out on me and it worked. And I was like, well, when I say worked, it helped. And so, and so that's how I eventually, you know, found your mom and started chatting with her about all these different things. And she was like, this guy, how does this guy find that? She's like, we're talking the same language here.
I love it. You are one of the chosen few. That's how I look at it. Who discovered OBM.
Well, let's put it this way. The Lomation products are good, I think, and they're helpful and they're beneficial. And that's why your mom does what she does. And I think, you know, that's why we do what we do. So I think we have the same common goal as this was not a business that was started to make money. It was a business that was started to help people. If we also make money, well, that'd be nice.
Yeah.
because that helps people too.
Totally.
Including sons.
Yes.
Maybe. But the point is, she didn't start it. She didn't start it that for that purpose. And I didn't either. And I think that's what makes us, you know, very like-minded.
I love it. Yeah. That's a great reason to start a business. To want to make a real difference.
It is. It's not, you know, most people would tell you, well, like I told you, it's, you know, sort of a hobby that became a business rather than a business that was developed for mostly business purposes. Business is great because you can make money, hopefully. But if you start a business, it's a hobby. You better not expect to make money, at least not right away anyway.
Yeah. So when you first started making Third Rock Sunblock, was it just that you were just making it for your family and friends?
That's correct. In the garage.
In the garage. That's where all great companies start, don't you know?
That's right. And I'm sure the same thing's true for your grandfather and your mom, right? I mean, they didn't start out sending it, you know, out and putting it on the internet. Of course, the internet's only been around since the company's been around. So we didn't even sell anything on the internet for the first 7 or 8 years because I hadn't perfected the formulation. It took me almost 10 years to perfect the sunscreen formulation.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
It's been thoroughly vetted, you guys.
Oh, my gosh. Definitely.
That's awesome. Yeah, my grandpa.
Yeah, I was actually hired by Burt's Bees to make their sunscreen.
Oh, really?
For them. Yeah, the long story short on that was it didn't work out, but instead of them continuing with me, they sold out to Clorox in 2007 for almost $1 billion. And so I sort of went by the wayside, and attorney said, you know, don't bother with them. You've got a good formulation here. Why don't you pursue it and commercialize it yourself? And I had a kinesiologist, a chiropractor who used to sit at his son's tennis games, and he called me on a Saturday morning. I thought, oh my gosh, something's wrong. He says, if you don't commercialize the sunscreen, then there's a real injustice that you've done to the world because your stuff is better than anything I've ever tried. He said, I was in the sun for 12 straight hours yesterday, and he said, and he's pale white. And he says, usually I can't even move the next day. He goes, I had more energy at the end of the tennis match on Friday night than I did before I started.
That's awesome. So it was your duty to mankind.
It was.
I love that.
It was. Well, for more than one reason, obviously to protect surfers, including me. So there is some selfish motivation there. I wanted to keep surfing past age, 30, and didn't want to get melanoma for sure. Right.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of self motivation. And then, of course, yeah, for friends, family, I said, well, let's, you know, honestly, they were guinea pigs at first.
Yeah. God bless them.
That's right.
No animal.
But
cruelty.
We've all survived. None of us have melanoma. That's the good news.
Yeah.
I'm starting to get to the age where, you know, there's a 50-50 chance I could get it. So that's not good.
Yeah.
And that's for people who don't surf.
Gotcha.
So, yeah.
You said Burt's Bee. What's it called? Burt's mm-hmm. Beeswax?
Burt's Bees. Uh-huh.
Burt's Bees. They were bought out by the company that owns Clorox?
They were bought out by Clorox directly. That's right. That is correct.
I was under the impression Clorox was like a, I don't know, Johnson & Johnson or Procter & Gamble.
They are, but they wanted to diversify their portfolio to sustainable, green, renewable stuff. And Burt's Bees at that time was the 500, 800-pound gorilla in the business. And the woman who started the company sold it to an investment firm for $80 million, but kept 80% of it for her, or yeah, kept 20% of it for herself. And then 2 years later, they flipped it for $987 million, and she got 20% of that.
Wow.
And Burt got nothing except his name on the label and getting to go to South Korea where he was a icon, but unfortunately he passed away about 4 or 5 years ago.
Oh. Well, thank you for your service, Burt.
Right. She kicked poor Burt to the curb.
Yeah, poor Burt, man. I hope Burt got a couple bucks.
Not much, from what I understand. Not much. There's a Netflix movie on Burt. You can watch it. It's sort of heartbreaking because he's just a very, very decent beekeeper from Maine who really was a hermit, and she sort of took advantage of his good nature.
Yeah, fantastic. I've been looking for more evidence of something to be upset about in this world. So thank you. I'll go check it out.
No, you don't need more.
I don't need more. There's plenty of nonsense.
That's right.
That's too bad. Well, it's been awesome chatting with you, Dr. Groon.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for swinging by. And I'd love to have you come and have another chat. Maybe we can hone in on polymers and really dive deep into that and the effects of that, the potential health effects, maybe some of the maybe there's like some information that's like, because I mentioned earlier that you should probably throw out your Teflon, and you're like, oh, well, it's really the making of Teflon is the problem, right? Is when they manufacture
it. It is. The making of Teflon is an issue, as well as if you overheat the Teflon, it will cause vapor, and there can be some issues there. But we could discuss, there's a lot we could discuss for a long period of time, not just the plastics, but we could talk more about sunscreens. We could talk more about toxicities. We could talk more about remedies for COVID.
Yes. Yeah. So I'd love to have you back in a little bit, and I'll email you. I'll shoot you some ideas. Kind of a suggested guideline or bullet points for next show. But yeah, I mean, you've got all this education, you've got all this experience, I'm sure some great stories. So yeah, thank you so much.
We could even talk about intellectual property and patents.
You know,
what I teach at Duke is I teach how to value patents. I have patents on valuing patents.
That's awesome. Yeah, I would love to talk to you more about your patent work and sort of the patent process. That's all very interesting. So yeah, thank you so much, Gary. It's been awesome chatting with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I enjoyed it a lot, very much. And best to you and, of course, your family.
Yeah, likewise.
And I really, really appreciate this. And once you decide what you're going to do with all this, let me know, and we might be able to put it on our website or something.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you want to tell our listeners where they can find you?
Sure. So you go to www.thirdrockessentials.com. It's the number 3, RD, rock, R-O-C-K, essentials.com. And we are also on Amazon, although we'd much prefer you to go to our website if you're going to buy any of our stuff. And of course, you can contact us directly through the website. Amazon doesn't care anything about us.
Yeah. Go directly to the site, guys. Support Gary. He's an awesome guy. He's one of these people who's trying to shine a light on a subject and rectify the situation. And he spent 10 years creating this amazing, more healthy option. So go check out Gary. Go support him. He's awesome. So, yeah, thanks again, Gary. Greatly appreciate you.
Oh, this has been great. I really appreciate everything, Brian. Thank you very much. I look forward to speaking with you again soon.
Yes, likewise. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday, and have a Merry Christmas if I don't talk to you.
Oh, you too as well. Thank you.
All right. Take care, my friend. Everybody, hope you enjoyed my chat with the Gare Bear, and be sure to be on the lookout for that shark attack prevention device of his, you know, but whatever you do, don't get eaten by the shark. Just try not to. Peace.